Welcome back to the Textual Talk. In today's episode, HD interviews Shaleya Morissette, a leader who's been making waves in the industry for over 15 years. From overcoming personal challenges, including homelessness and career uncertainty, to landing a life-changing role in a major utility company. Shaleya shares her candid journey into the world of energy and how her path led her to become the VP of Partnerships and Strategic Initiatives at Walker Miller Energy Services, the largest female minority-owned energy service company in the nation. Together, they unpack the surprising opportunities in the energy sector, the importance of mentorship, and the real impact of diversity, equity, and inclusion in technical fields. You hear how Shaleya's educational journey from business to nuclear engineering meets her passion for supporting others, including founding Chieftess Consulting and creating coloring books celebrating real women scientists. Plus, she shares actionable advice for young professionals, especially Black women, looking to break into STEM and how energy careers can shape not only personal success, but entire communities. If you ever wondered how to get into the energy sector, what true equity looks like at work, or how to leverage your unique experiences to drive meaningful change, this episode is for you. Get ready for an honest, energizing, and inspiring conversation you won't want to miss. Enjoy the show. Welcome back to the Textual Talk Podcast. I'm your host, HD, and got another episode for y'all. But first and foremost, if you're listening on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or any other podcast streaming platform, please follow us, leave us a review. It'll really help us out. And if you're still watching right now, just hit the like button. Now, this guest has came all the way from Boston to be with us today. We tried to do this remotely and at work, so it was meant to be that we do it in person. But we have none other than Miss Shaleya Morissette.
Hey.
How you doing today?
I'm good. Thank you for having me.
So I didn't get a chance to give you like a Shannon Sharp intro where you list off all the accolades and like everything they have going on. But could you introduce yourself to the listeners?
Yeah, it'll be lengthy, but I'll try to keep it as concise as possible.
That's fine.
Most folks say, oh, where'd you go to school? What are your degrees in? And so I have a bachelor's degree in business. I have a master's degree in education. I am in my last course for finishing up a second bachelor's in nuclear engineering. I have been in energy for the last 15 years. And so I started with a major utility company in the Northeast. And then I transitioned to teaching and working at the utility company. I was doing a lot of nonprofit work, all the goods, which led me to working for the U.S. Department of Energy down in D.C. Today, I am the Vice President of Partnerships Strategic Initiatives for Walker Miller Energy Services out of Detroit. It's the largest female minority-owned energy services company in the nation. That's the goods. Outside of that, I'm a mom. I'm a sister to three crazy brothers. But more importantly, I started a company called Chieftess Consulting Group, which I was able to develop a coloring book featuring amazing women in my life. And so it was really to just showcase real people, not just the typical big names that we all know of, but really scientists, women that are just incredible that I think people should know.
Nice. Thank you. Do you have it?
Do I have one with me? I don't have one with me, but I can give you the website, all the things.
Okay.
Yeah.
Perfect. Perfect. For sure. Now, that's a lot of stuff.
That was a lot of stuff. Yeah.
But I know we briefly talked about, I guess, like we'll go to the intermediate period between like after school and figuring out what you want to do post school. Like, what was that like for you?
I was a hot mess. I graduated and I got married while I was in college. And I graduated and got divorced. And I was homeless. I had nowhere to go. I went from Georgia back to the Northeast and I had to live with my brother, who was in a one-bedroom apartment with himself, his girlfriend, a dog, my stepdad, and my baby brother, and then me. And so I was sleeping in a crawl space. And I said, okay, to be competitive in this market, I need a master's degree. I'm not taking out any more loans. And so I was very, very targeted. And I said, I'm going to go work in higher education and get the degree. That's exactly what I did. And so with that, outside of that, strategic initiative that I started, I did everything. I worked in a pharmacy. I worked in a tanning salon. It was anything to make money to get myself out of the situation. That's what I did. Then a friend of mine who I had met at the pharmacy came in one day because I was still working two jobs, even though I did start working in higher education. And he said, you should come to this job fair. I'm like, what are you talking about? He said, come and work with National Grid. You'll get in. You got your degree. You're shoo-in. And so I got all dressed up and I'm at work. And my best friend who I'm working with at the time, she's like, you got an interview? Where are you going? And I said, I do. Do you want to come with me? So we take our lunch break and we go to this career fair. They like her and they don't like me. And I'm like, you took what I thought was going to be life-changing. But I love her. And so I was happy for her and I called the same person and I was like, yo, you said that I was a shoo-in. Like, help me out. And so he made a call and got me an official interview. I take the real interview, and before I got to the parking lot, they made me an offer I couldn't refuse. I didn't know how much money was involved with energy. I had no plans to go into energy. Once I got in, I was discovering this mammoth that is utilities. I mean, they are the gatekeepers to everything. We're all going to pay an energy bill. But there are so many nuances, so many pieces to the machine that I had to learn everything. It was exciting. It was really, really exciting. So, and what's more interesting about the story is that my best friend, unfortunately, the woman who raised her, passed away the weekend before her interview. And so she didn't do well in the follow-up interview, and she didn't get the job. Well, I got the job. 3 months later, I stepped into a leadership role, and they said, we have to backfill your position. And I said, oh my gosh, you already interviewed her. It wasn't a good time. Can I bring her in for an interview? Yes. Go through the process. She gets the job. So now we're both in energy. She's still in energy, which is my favorite part. But it was sort of the divine intervention that I thought it wasn't going to work out, and it totally did. And it changed our lives.
Nice. So funny you say that. Like, when you think about it, like, nobody really thinks about energy, but it's like, it's one of those things that's always going to be here.
Always.
And it's like, you rarely see, like, I can't recall anybody I think about outside of you and others about working in energy. So when you say it was a life-changing offer, like,
I'll give you real numbers.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think I was making like $44,000. Their offer was $90,000.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's life-changing. That'll do it.
Yeah.
That was, I mean, I couldn't believe it. I went into the office, you know, to give my 2 weeks notice, and I'm all excited. And I loved my boss at the college. And I said, Mark, I got to show you this. I give him the letter and he says, all right, what are they offering you? I tell him and he's like, I can't even come close. Most colleges are nonprofit. They can't afford you at that level. And he says, I want you to do it. I want you to do it well. Go forth and do. And so the 3 months later, when I hire my friend, she was also at the college, remember? Mm-hmm. And they're like, okay, enough of this.
You're
like,
taking everybody.
You're taking everybody. She had been there for like 16 years. And so this was a big deal that we both left. So in the energy world, you don't realize what's happening around you. But for the last 20 years, it's been this massive push with new technology. So everything that you think of in terms of the really complex systems, that's all there. But it's a business. It's finance, it's marketing, it's all the things. It's a massive operation in all the ways. So there's a place for everybody. You just got to look for it.
Yeah. And so in your specific first like energy role leading into the leadership role, what was like your job function?
Oh my gosh, I was doing permitting. So I was essentially responsible for getting a permit to open up a roadway to basically either put in new pipe for natural gas or to repair piping. These utility companies, although they own what they call the asset in the ground, they don't own the road. So you've got to get permission to get to your stuff. I was responsible for 26 different cities for all the communication, to talk to them and say, hey, this is what we're doing. But also in communicating with the folks in the field. So being able to talk to them and say, we don't have a permit. What can we do? Customers would call us. They're upset. They want a new line. Then you're dealing with the engineering folks. And they're like, I don't care what you have to do. Get a permit. Then there's all the paperwork. Now, you're in energy, and you're supposed to be as efficient as possible in terms of saving the environment. We were still dealing with paper. And so I stepped into this role, and I was like, okay, we got to figure out a way that we can eliminate all this paper. And so I said, will you let me? To my boss at the time. She was like, I've been doing this 26 years and nobody's ever been able to do it. Go ahead. As long as it doesn't cost us anything, do it. So of course I figure out, okay, we can do some scanning. We can use Adobe. We can use some file systems. It's completely paperless now. Still is to this day. That was 7-8 years ago. Well, 15 years ago. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. That's good. They were at least embracing the change.
Yeah.
Because you'll go so many places where it's like, well, we're not doing that because this is the way it's always been. It's the way it will be. And a lot of people, or we like to joke and talk about like the boomers.
Oh, yeah.
You know, they're going to make it the way that they always wanted to be, which I see them still doing that, but they're holding on for dear life now.
Yeah.
It's about time for all of them to kind of relinquish the reins and just go retire and let the Gen Xers and the millennials come run the show. Because I think a lot of the time, I think a lot of them are out of touch with a lot of things.
Especially in technology.
Yes, for sure.
I'll give them that. But I don't want to devalue their contributions because
yeah.
some of the things that I learned from the older generation or folks that had just, I'll call them legacy, folks that this was their only job and their entire career was at the utility company. They really showed for me the mistakes that were made to get us where we are today. I would literally ask the question of, why do we do it this way? Well, there was an explosion on this date and we learned this, this, and this. Oh, okay. Instead of just, we've always done it this way. Sometimes if you are able to really establish a relationship,
yeah.
they'll give you the goods. They'll give you the real information that makes sense. And it's usually undocumented when it correlates to a system or a process. It's just, we learned, we do it this way now, and most people will adopt that this is the way it is.
Agreed. So what are some things that you took from education into the energy industry?
Oh, gosh. I'll tell you one thing that I was surprised about first because it's hilarious. Coming from academia, it was full dissertations in emails, right? When I got to the utility space, people would put their entire email, like the body of the email, was in the subject line. So I would, it would be an empty email, but the entire email, their questions, everything are in the subject line. So I'm doing a copy paste trying to read it without having to go through every letter. It was the wildest thing that in a corporate setting, they did not have the grooming credentials that I was used to. It was wild to me. And it wasn't like that with everyone, but I had never seen it in higher ed. It was like, this is not normal, right? But a lot of the sort of rigor of research, being in higher ed, it was verify everything. Where's your sources? Are you making this up? Trust no one. And so that really came into play when I started learning all the things in energy. It was like, wait, how do you know that? Where did that come from? Was that a degree? Was that a person? Was that historical? Where did that come from? It gave me a really hard time when trying to have a conversation because I had a million questions. A million questions. I think I really drove some folks crazy. I did.
Yeah. No, I mean, but the funny thing is when we think about, I think I've said plenty of times, it's like how sometimes in college, they don't give people, I guess like technically, if I was doing college curriculums, I would have one course called corporate.
Oh, yeah.
Where I literally teach you corporate etiquette on how to email and things to send. Like, because I didn't learn that till like my very first job in corporate.
Really?
Yeah. As far as just things to say, how to say things in a third person, how to talk a little bit more high level, how, you know, not to let how you feel come into the email.
Yeah. Unless,
you know, most people know people have an attitude. They say, per my last email, you know, something like that. But for the most part, people forget that, hey, like all these people have not had the same training. So you're trying to deal with that. And I learned that. Obviously, I did. I supported the IT help desk for TSA for 2 years at the beginning of my career. So we were dealing with the screeners.
Yeah.
For the people that are doing all that stuff, you start realizing, okay, all these people are not computer literate.
Right.
And then you're like, these are the people that's trying to make sure we don't bring nothing in here.
Makes you question.
Yeah, it does. And now I will say that was, 11 years ago. So I think the times I've been to the airport now, it's been much better with the scanning technology and stuff like that.
But I feel like it has gotten slower. Just going to say that it does feel like it's gotten slower. I've been traveling for the last 3.5 years nonstop. Mm-hmm. And there's some new technology out that may make the process of identifying things better, but it really can slow you down. And I am a last minute person when it comes to flights because I'm usually not carrying anything. I go right through. But now I'm seeing that even if it's just a purse, it's taking forever. It's taking like an additional 20 minutes at some airports. Yeah. Because there's new scanners. And so it just is a one by one. Atlanta is the perfect example. All of the new machines require that one bucket goes, another bucket goes. Whereas Boston, it's not a bucket system, right? They haven't updated all the machines. So we're still on a conveyor belt running through. Hurry up. Let's go.
Yeah. That's the same way at, I don't know how it is flying out of DFW, but at Love Field, they've updated everything now to where, like it used to be when I would fly, hey, put your laptop right here and put this right here. But now it's just, hey, leave everything in the bag. It's going through the scanner.
Right.
Stand through the little thing, put your hands up, and you're good.
We're getting there. We'll get better. We'll get better.
Yeah.
Slowly but surely. But to your point about sort of the grooming that it takes, in my undergrad, we did exactly that sort of training. So we had an etiquette dinner. And it got really into the weeds, the details of how do you introduce your boss to your partner, right? How do you introduce your boss's boss, right? There's a different level of how do you hand your card to someone when they are higher ranking, especially if you were going to go to the military after. What does that look like for someone who is at a military dinner and you're the spouse? Who's introduced first? Do you say, this is my wife, this is, you know, my senior officer? What does that look like? Those simple things can make or break you in terms of, are you good enough to be around the most elite? It's a lot of judgment too.
Yeah.
And I think for someone like myself who looks young, I'm older than what I look, that sort of hit me in the gut a couple times of like, I do know the right fork. I've done these dinners. Mm-hmm. Like, why are you trying me? You know, where people would tell me it's that fork. I know what I'm doing. So a lot of insults definitely came as I went through the ranks. And even when I transitioned to working for the federal government, I went and learned how to play golf. And people thought I was crazy. And I was like, I'm going to be surrounded by white men.
That's what I actually have been saying for the longest. I want to learn to play golf and I want to get into pickleball.
Pickleball is the fastest growing sport. I hate it. I hate it. But if you want to be in an older crowd, don't beat them up, right? I'll tell you that because you'll be really good, right? It takes a lot of stamina. But yeah, it also has the most injuries too.
Yeah. Honestly, for me, I've been so busy. I used to, when I was kid free, I would play basketball like 2 times a week. Can't really do that anymore because yeah. I'm working around the clock. So
yeah, you're doing all the things.
But no, that's cool and interesting that you said, like a lot of white men. I like to bring this topic up. As always, I like to get people's various opinions, and I'll tell you where I stand on it. This is not written down either. So I'm going to preface it like this. Have you been managed in your career by any like older black women?
Yes.
How was that experience for
terrible.
You?
Terrible.
Really?
Absolutely terrible.
And I'm getting these questions because I'll tell you why. I'm going to drive the point home in a second. Were these like older boomers / like silent generation folks or what?
It has been all levels. So having, you know, I was early 30s, having closer to 50, having, again, late 30s, having someone that was closer to 50, but really, really accomplished women. Like right now, I have an older Black female woman. She's amazing. She's amazing. But it's her company. She's built it from the ground up. And so it's very, very different versus folks that were attorneys and sort of rose through different ranks. It's interesting. It can be great and it can be awful.
Yeah. Do you think that some of those people actually should have been in management to begin with?
No.
So the reason why I'm asking, because there was this viral TikTok that I reacted to on my podcast last week, and it was a Somalian woman talking about how if the manager is a Black woman, you know, I don't want the job, give it back, give me a white man. And so that she said, and she was just saying all these things. And I was like, I understand everybody saying, hey, they've had bad experiences.
Of course.
But I was like, if you go out there and just highlight and say this all the time, and I was saying this, and this was like to like a lot of different Black women as well. I was like, so you mean tell me you're going to be a bad manager one day? if that's what we want to live by? And because I was like, truth be told, I was like, when you said, oh, please give me a white man, I was like, I want you to realize that, hey, during election season, they show that they don't really care about you.
No,
so
they don't.
When you're saying that, I was like, I think it's like a slap in the face. I was like, to be honest, because I did the statistics. I was like, I looked up how many black women were in the management. I think it was like less than 3%.
Right.
I did not look up how many black men were in management. They couldn't even give me a number. So I was like, a lot of us don't even get a chance to even manage. So I was like, it could be skewed based on, you know, hey, they probably got this woman to do this because they, unfortunately, they do give black women the stereotype like, hey, if you want something done and somebody to ride your workers like they're her kids, she will do it. So that's why sometimes I think why they probably do that, you know, give you a hard time. Or it's just, I've seen where it's been misunderstandings where people finally have to sit down and you talk with one another and you find out, you know, hey, we have more things that are like than different or whatever. Or
yes,
sometimes maybe you guys remind them of their daughters. And I don't know why mother and daughter relationships are so pretentious.
It's supposed to be, right? It's natural, right? Even in the animal kingdom, it's natural, yeah. Right? I've seen it a million times. There is, there are different methodologies that you can step into that sort of management situation. You can fly under the radar. You can use the 48 laws of power. Don't mm-hmm. ever outshine the master. Yeah. In spaces and places where a manager who is a black woman is the only, that tends to be more stressful because if she's not in position to lift you up, she wants to subdue you. Mm-hmm. That's where it's just not healthy. That's why a lot of black women say, nope, I don't want to do it. Versus I've been a manager and I can give you in a team of 10, the broad spectrum of opinions about me, right? We do these 360 yeah. sort of evaluations of tell me how terrible I am. And I've gotten, you know, Shalaya is the most supportive manager I've ever had. I've got direct feedback that says I've never seen a black woman support black men and mean it in the mm-hmm. way that you do. And then I get the opposite end of she doesn't know what she's doing. I could do her job. She's not as good as everybody says that she is. And that comes from someone who has been in that role for 30 years, right? And maybe they could have done it better, but you didn't apply. And so you are then upset that I got the job. The reality is I didn't give myself the job.
Yeah.
Somebody chose me. Right. Mm-hmm. Somebody saw something in me I clearly qualified for because it's dangerous to give somebody a job that they're not qualified for. And so you get this wide range. For me, I like leading from behind. Most people don't like public speaking. I happen to be very good at it. And so I've always been put in that sort of position. That breeds a different type of hate. Because either people say, I want to be able to do that. And you make it look easy. And I want to be you. And they don't realize how difficult it is, or they think this is like an overnight success yeah. sort of thing. They think she didn't work for it. She didn't pay thousands of dollars for training. She just woke up and she's like this, or everybody says she has personality. Well, what's so special? And then there's people that say, well, I want to do that, but I'm not willing to do the work.
That's what I was going to get to. I was like, everyone wants to be you. And they're like, oh, she's so good at speaking, but they don't want to practice speaking. They don't want to learn how to articulate their points and kind of stick to something, their flow and figure out how it's going. They don't want to do none of that.
Yeah.
But they want to do what you want to do.
Yeah.
And I also was going to add the fact that I was to bring the point home was about, I said, you guys realize like it's already a disparity of us in the workforce. And a lot of times we're not getting hired because we're just not the right hue.
Right.
I was like, so when you say all these people are not good managers, these could be particularly some people that could possibly help you get in. I know my black managers have been great. One of them helped me, get a role. And of course, the person that was over her was a white woman, but she remembered me from a previous company. Mm-hmm. And so I didn't really have to interview her because I had already did good work somewhere else. But one of my best managers is a white woman still to this day. Me and a couple of my friends, all of us had her as a manager. It's like, yeah, she's the best, but I'm not out here just saying, oh, please give me a white woman. I'm just
no.
like, I'm just doing everybody's like their old isolated thing. And like, even me talking about, like, I've had a black older man that's wearing my dad's age as a manager. Great manager. Good guy.
It's individual.
He had the soft skills, too, as well, like, to talk to me. When I told him I was leaving the company, he was like, you know, I'm not surprised. He just knew because he had kids that was around my age. So I just think everything is nuanced, and sometimes people don't even look at themselves to figure out, like, hey, was I a hard person to even manage?
That part. That part. Nobody's willing to have that conversation with themselves to say, if I had to manage me, how fun would that be? Do we get the job done? Am I a slacker? This is the college experience at its finest. If you have to work on a team, even if you are an individual contributor, how well do you work with others? What everybody in the corporate space won't admit is that we hire people that we like. We hire people that we think will get along with the rest of the team because you spend 8 hours a day with people. And I don't want to work with people I don't like.
Yep.
If I have to, if I inherit people that I just innately say, I really don't like this person, I'll deal with it. I'm not going to treat you any differently, but I'm also not going to invite you to come hang out with me later. I'm not going to maybe dive in and really get to know you. But that's the reality. Everybody says, well, I'm qualified. You being qualified doesn't mean that you're the right fit. And that self-evaluation of how well do I work in teams? What am I willing to do? Do I just have a bad attitude? Because nobody is real enough to say, you know what? I'm a Black woman and I'm not going for all of the BS and I'm going to tell you about yourself. Nobody wants to manage that. Nobody wants to manage confrontation every single day when they come into the workplace. Mm-hmm. That every time I ask you to do your job, it's a problem. You give me a rebuttal that is just nasty. Mm-hmm. And that is already the stereotype. And when you fulfill that stereotype, it's so horrible for the rest of us. And you have someone like myself. I know what the stereotype is. You're a Black woman. You're light skinned. You got long hair. Right? It's all the things. And so other Black women will look at me and say, well, you only got hired because you're pretty. Okay. I'll take that. But I'm going to do all the work mm-hmm. so that you can never say to me, she's not good enough.
Yeah. It's funny though. In one of my business classes in undergrad, the professor actually talked about at least in retail sense, hiring attractive people.
Yeah.
Make you feel a little bit more comfortable.
Yeah. It's crazy. But again, the human mind will put us in categories, right? Whatever we're comfortable with is the box that we build for people. It's unfair, but it also is an innate thing that's a human trait to keep us alive. Mm-hmm. We put danger in a box. We put safety in a box. And I know how to identify those things based on my human experience and my genetic makeup, right? That's the realest part to it. But so many of us are unwilling to accept it.
Yeah, for sure. Now, speaking of that, one of the questions I had down here was about you've been a driving force for diversity in the energy sector. What does true equity look like to you in this space?
Oh, true equity looks like no more first. I'm so tired of being the first Black female board member, the first Black woman to do it, the first. I want to get to a point where, regardless of color, is it an equitable system? Are we looking at the situations in people's lives and saying, that's unfair, right? Does this make sense? And I'm not mixing the two in terms of equality to equity. That's not what I'm saying at all. What I would, in an ideal world, say is that could we all have access to clean energy that's affordable? Yes, we could. We could. Could we save the one planet that we're on by doing things in a more equitable way? Yes. Yes, we could. We're not asking energy companies to plant trees for all of their emissions. We're not asking that of them. We should. There's a lot more to be done in the energy field that would be to the benefit of everyone. Mm-hmm. That is really the ideal situation.
Quick question. Does water fall under energy?
Yes. Yes.
And the reason why I said that, when you said, I think you said clean resources. Mm. When it comes to places like Flint and these other places with these water problems, maybe that state, local level.
It's all, right? So it is a federal issue. It's a state issue. It's a local issue because there are citizens there. These are real people that can't drink their own water. And so Flint has been happening for how many years now? Down in Mississippi, there mm-hmm. are thousands of cities and towns that don't have clean drinking water. This is a human issue. It's a human issue. There are inventions that could solve the problem. Are we willing to fund it? Doesn't look like it. I know of two women that came up with an invention in partnership with MIT during their PhD research. Their name of the company is Aquasaic, and they found a particular type of yeast could extract all heavy metals from water. I helped them, and I said, you need to talk to this person, that person. Every private equity fund, go after it, get the money. Here's some grant information, go after it. What they found was when they flipped the switch and said, we can extract heavy metals for use to do other things. Now investors were interested. The human issue is not as profitable, right? That's the truth.
Yeah.
It's not as profitable in business. And until we get to the point where in the business world, we see that the social issue is worth solving because it will have economic impacts. We're going to be stuck in this cycle.
Yeah. I don't think they care. That reminds you when you think about like going to the doctor, hospitals, mm-hmm. pharmacy, big tech, to yeah. where, hey, I make more money giving you the antibiotics versus curing you. So that's kind of what that reminds me of. And that's why you just got to be a little bit cynical, like every time something happens, like, man.
But people are getting smarter. Even doctors now, you know, my mom, she's a news watcher, and she called me. She said, oh my gosh, they're bringing back doctors coming to you. So doctors are tired of the insurance system because without insurance, I could get, and I just did this recently with everything with a fighting match. You know, he had to go get an MRI. I'm thinking to myself, oh my gosh, this is going to cost $6,000. It's going to be crazy. We got the MRI for $500 with no insurance.
Wow.
We got an EKG. So we get an MRI, CT scan, EKG, stress test, physical, okay, eye exam. All of that done for less than $2,000.
Wow.
What they would have charged the insurance companies had we run everything through insurance? Well over 10 grand. Easily. Just for the MRI, that would have been $6,000. And so now you see the system saying, well, if this doctor's willing to do it without insurance and it's cash money, it's cheaper than my copay. Why would I get insurance? Yes, you may need it for massive surgeries, but it's sort of like finding that vet that does limited hours for free. It can be done. Yeah. It's just a matter of who is willing to do it. Can we then honor them with a donation instead of massive payments that we don't have?
Yeah. I mean, I don't even remind me. It's just like everything goes up. You like, I mean, outside of going to the doctor, everything else, like when it comes to the insurance, like, man, this stuff is just, you have people that will forego even getting insurance at work because it takes so much out of their check.
Yes. And if you never use it, you never get that money back. So it's, come on. At some point, you know, even the older generation is saying this is a scam.
It's like car insurance. Like,
yes.
It's like, it's too much. And then if you don't have a wreck for 10 years, you've paid these people at least what we'll just say you pay $200 a month.
Right.
And you pay them what? That's 200. That's, we're going to say it's $2,500.
Easily.
So you pay like $25,000.
Yeah.
Over that time. So
and don't get me started on homeowners insurance, right? And if you cash in too many times, they'll drop you. You could lose your house in that process. The bank says it has to be insured. We're only giving you this loan if it stays insured. So 25 years of paying it, 30 years of paying it, and you never cash in.
Mm-hmm.
You've just thrown money away.
Yeah. The more and more as I get older, I do understand why people just get fed up, say, I'll just let y'all have everything. I'll go live life on my terms and be homeless.
Yes.
Because I don't have to pay no bills. If I can find it. I understand that rationale. It's a hard life, but I definitely do understand it because it's like, everything is just a game and you're a cog into the system and you're just over it.
It gives you perspective. My brother and I got to a place where I recognized that his idea of happiness was not my idea of happiness, right? He was not going to ever step into the realm of, I want to go to college. I want to do all the things. He was certified genius at 5 years old. And so he looked at school and said,
I'm bored.
This doesn't make sense. This is conditioning. You want me to get up, stand up, and do all the things at the sound of a bell? This has been done in experiments over the years. Like, you're just trying to get me ready to go into a job. I'm not going for it. And so his mindset is to live a simple life. He's not extravagant. He doesn't want for much. His kids are taken care of. But if he could go live on a compound somewhere, he would.
Yeah,
he absolutely would.
I totally understand. I think I said that. In I forgot a couple episodes a while back, but we were talking about one of the big things on social media was about, you know, why you don't see a lot of black men in school and all these other stuff. And you start seeing how it's not really catered to boys and these other things and how boys learn differently. But you want them to kind of sit down all day. And we need to be going to get our exercise. And honestly, it doesn't take 8 hours a day to teach all that stuff. It's, you know, it's a lot on top of kids are bad. These kids are, well, they're not bad. They're just not nurtured.
They're not nurtured. They're not conforming to our social norms. Our social norms were truly influenced by us being afraid of getting a beating. Like, It's different now. We can't do that. When you try, there's the school intervening, a nurse intervening, the government intervening, you know, generations intervening, saying you shouldn't do that. And nobody has the answer. We said it earlier. There's no handbook to parenting. So nobody can tell you, I got it right. Sometimes I think we forget that you're going to have kids. My mother says it best. You never know if you're going to like your kids. You don't know if they're going to like you. You hope that they do, right? And so when you get them and you don't have them with the intention of raising assets to society, tends to go a little left, right? You know, the philosophy for so long that we've all heard is that I only have to raise you until you're 18. Get your stuff and get out at graduation. Figure it out, not my problem. There's a whole generation that was their philosophy of 18 and I'm done with you. I don't have to have anything to do with you. You made it out of high school. That was the standard. Today, we're seeing more people say, you have to go to college. But we're not telling them that, oh yeah, you should probably consider a trade school. Because I don't need another engineer. I need a plumber. When they're knocking at the door and I need them for $400 an hour, I'm mad that I have this engineering degree, but I can't understand how my toilet works. Mm-hmm. There's this theory of the disillusion of knowledge. We think we know how things work and we have no idea. It's the simplest things in our lives that we know how to use. We don't know how it works. And so we are failing our children in a lot of ways by saying, only pursue college. Don't even think about trade schools, even for high school. We're not exposing them at a young enough age to all the technical pieces of life.
Yeah. Even then, I just think, you know, truth be told, if we go back to how it used to be, college wasn't meant for everybody.
It wasn't.
It's only supposed to probably meant for a couple of kids.
Yeah. You know,
there are other ways. But that comes with planning and actually paying attention to your kids and see what this one will be good at, this one, and trying to figure out what they want to do and kind of enhance what they would gravitate
to. That's having kids with intention, right? So many of us are stuck in survival mode that we don't even get the chance to enjoy our kids. We don't get to see who they are naturally of, oh, you know, such and such can take things apart, put them back together. That's sometimes just innate. Mm-hmm. We're not paying attention because we're so busy working.
Yep.
And I remind people all the time, you know, your job, your title is not going to be on your headstone.
Yep.
But in truth, mother, daughter, sister, that's what's going to be on there. It's the relationships. Forget everything else. I'm not saying don't do your job well. Don't be proud of what you do. But end of the day, when you retire, God willing, it's your family. Mm-hmm. It's the relationships that you've built that satisfy you. Mm-hmm. It's nothing else like it. You can accomplish all the things. You can make all the money. But if you are 70 and alone.
Yeah. It don't mean nothing.
Nothing.
And trust me. It was like a while back. I was going to the chiropractor for some stuff. I was like on a plan to get adjusted and stuff throughout. Like, I think 2 times a week. And I had seen this very old couple come in there with each other. They had to be 70s, 80s. And I was like, that's really what it's about.
Yes.
I was like, I always say all the time, and we got like all this rhetoric, you know, the men going this way about, well, I'm scared to get married because of all this. Mind you, most of the people that are scared to get married don't even have money to be taken.
True story.
And then, you know, you have the women who some of them are successful and others aren't, but they realize, hey, well, as long as I have my kids, I can use the system to my benefit and I don't really need a man. And not realizing, like, once that allotted time is up, it's just going to be you.
It's just going to be you.
And by the time you get back out there, life is going to pass you by. And, you know, you can hope somebody wants you at that time versus trying to fixate on just making sure, like, you can make it work with somebody. And I don't think people, they're only thinking about, like, the right now and not thinking about what happens later. Hey, who's going to be there to help make sure you take all your pills and all that. Mm-hmm. And mind, this is, you know, thinking if you don't have kids.
Right.
Now, if you got kids, you may look up if they like you.
If they like you, you right.
Maybe you don't got to go to the nursing home. Maybe you go stay with one of the kids, which I hope, you know, I just get to stay with one of my daughters.
Right. Please take care of me. You know,
just give me a sitter because right. I'm like, I don't, them people don't really watch all those people.
But think home. About that. Everything that you just said is based on what you put into those relationships. Your kids are going to take care of you because you took care of them in a big way. People show up for you because of how you show up for them. And it's even in marriages, in partnerships, whatever that looks like for you, it really is your commitment to the other person. Mm-hmm. If your partner is your competition, you're done. You're done. It's going to be miserable. It's going to be a nightmare, right? So finding the right person to procreate with, if that's what you decide, is crucial to a long, healthy life. It really is. If you then decide to have children and you don't say, I built something, it's my responsibility to give them the best opportunity. What are we doing? Right. Why are we doing it? What is the point of procreation if they're not meant to be the best version of themselves? You should be influencing that every day. Every day. If you just had them because, oops, it happened, there's a mental shift. I didn't intend on having my daughter. But the moment I found out that I was pregnant, it was like, okay, let's get busy because we got things to do. I can't have, you know, just a life that is unkept. I'm not hopping on a plane to go and hang out with my friends anymore. I'm not running to Miami. No. That money has to be put aside for her. I need to be buying art. I need to be making investments. It was a total shift that I was no longer important, but that little girl is going to be my legacy. What will it look like for the next 7 generations? That's how I'm making decisions mm-hmm. today. It's not normal in my family. I don't know how normal it is in other Black households, but that's my intention.
Yeah, for sure. It's not the norm. But I wanted to switch gears real quick because I remember in our prior conversation, you talked about, I think we were talking about either getting more minorities in energy. And I know you were telling me about a time where you guys were partnering with Southern University in Shreveport.
Yeah.
With was it like with Calumet or something?
So I came into the agency and they had this program already with Southern. And basically, we were trying to get more people into energy. Now, we could have gone to any HBCU and tried to launch this program. But Shreveport was interesting because you had a lot of petroleum companies already there. And it didn't make sense to sort of reinvent this wheel. They had the technology. They had everything they needed. We just needed the right recruiters. They needed money to support the professors. Mm-hmm. And so that's exactly what they did. They found the right kids. And they started at high school. They were grabbing seniors to say, come over here and take this certificate program that guaranteed you $70,000 for a certificate program. It was incredible. Yeah.
I wonder why they bring that back.
Listen, you know the current administration. That's why I'm not in the federal government anymore, mm-hmm. right? But there's a lot of private funds that are trying to do similar work, right? But Southern University is unique in that it's the only university system within the HBCU network. Now, I wish we could change that, that all HBCUs were linked together in terms of transferable credits, all the things, because I think that would be a game changer.
Yeah, because I know for sure that was something I never heard about when I was in high school. Like, I did dual enrollment, had like one dual enrollment course from Southern, and I think I had one from Grambling, but other mm-hmm. than that, we didn't hear anything about any like program. Granted, we weren't students at, you know, Southern University to kind of know about that.
Yeah,
either.
It's been traditional, right? So unless you were an engineer, you weren't really exposed to the energy industry, right, as mm-hmm. a whole. But more and more, there are energy finance degrees, there's energy policy, there's energy law, because it's pretty lucrative, right? Yeah. This is a $1 trillion industry.
People, yeah, like you had those people, like they'll be on social media, like petroleum engineers and stuff yes. like that. They'll do their day in a life, you know, yeah. they're in that nice car in Listen, Houston somewhere.
It's, I don't know anybody in energy making less than 6 figures, honestly. And it's not because of my level of where I am. That is like throughout industry, you can make a lot of money. And there's, of course, there's a lot of side hustles, a lot of stuff you can do. Once you are the expert in your lane of energy, you can really dictate your own path. It's wide open. I think that we're losing great minds to other industries. And so I'm hopeful. Yesterday I was up at Dartmouth College, and there were folks there, all minorities, and they were all studying different areas of energy, chemical engineers, material science, PhDs. I mean, these folks were just so focused on inventing things and doing research that mattered that I walked away with hope of, okay, it's not all lost. It's not all lost. So there are people here. We just need more.
Yeah. And speaking of that, let's talk about now Walker Miller Energy and some of the initiatives and things that you're trying to drive over there.
Yeah. So obviously VP of Partnership Strategic Initiatives, we do a lot of workforce development, but it's different. The wraparound services are, I think, probably the most impactful. Most people say wraparound services and it's like childcare. No. We're talking about mental health support. We're talking about financial literacy. We're talking about transportation, actual stipend. You're not just in a program learning something. It has a 90% pass rate. The first year we did it, so basically it's energy efficiency, right? You're going through this program. You're learning how to do audits. You're learning about building performance, all of the goods. And you don't need any experience, none. We teach you everything. When you graduate the program, we then assist you with getting placed into a job. We don't care if you pass the test, right? You're going to pass. You know this stuff by the end of it. That's a 7-week course. And so the bigger part to us is that you get a job. So when we first did it the first year, it was like $22.41 an hour. Now we're at $28.71. Mm. That's a big change.
Yes, it is.
We are committed to ensuring that 40% of the cohorts that we bring through are from Detroit, because that's where we're headquartered. And we also know that there's a backlog of energy audits that need to be done in that area on multifamily homes. They're the most vulnerable because they can't say, oh, I think I want my energy from this, and they're usually not informed enough to make that decision. And so when you see someone that looks like you, who's from your neighborhood, do this, inform you, you trust the systems a bit more. So that's just one of the program. The energy efficiency audits, we do them too, right? So we're in these homes doing this work. We work with what we call trade allies. And so they are contractors that we say, you're a good person, you do good work. We will recommend you. You become part of the roster. That's things like roofing. You can't get solar if your roof is getting ready to collapse, right? We can't recommend that and then sort of leave you hanging. So it's all the good. It's new windows, all of that. We use our partners to do that kind of work.
Perfect, perfect. Let's see. So this is a good one. Seems like some interview questions for real. What does success look like to you in your current role as VP of Partnerships and Strategic Initiatives?
Yeah, success for me in this role, at least in the first year, is 5 real partnerships that hopefully bring in about $10 million, right? When I say partnerships, I mean the non-traditional. It might not be a utility company. It might be a Google. It might be data centers that, you know, you want to upgrade some of these buildings if you're coming to Detroit or if you're in some of our service territories, Minnesota, right, Philadelphia, that area. You're going to come into those spaces. We want to be the providers that you come to and say, can you do this energy audit and tell us what we really need to do, right? That's, for me, the non-traditional partner that I'm looking for. Is like, how do we work together? How do we set the standard for industry in what most people are not thinking about energy has anything to do with, right? People think of data centers and we think computers, not realizing they are a massive energy burden.
Yeah. And speaking of that, with all the claims about AI, AI is going to be a massive energy burden. Yes. It already is.
It already is, yeah.
So it's just like, that's one of those things too where from an energy standpoint, is that a area for growth as well to support
Absolutely.
That?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, there's layers to this in the general population's understanding of AI, right? You know, Department of Energy has supercomputers. They've been in competition with all the other private entities, and people don't realize what they're used for. They've largely been used for computation, right? These mathematical equations that we as humans haven't been able to do. That's what they've been doing. But now they're processing data, large amounts of it. And so understanding that the more computation that we do, the heavier it's going to be on the energy grid. The water for cooling. You know, we talked about water a second ago. Where are you going to get this water? How are you going to bus it in and out? How are you going to keep it cool? Because in turn, right, it's really about keeping all of these servers cool. If they overheat in temperatures like 105 in the Northeast that we're not used to right now, we're going to have problems, right? And we are so reliant on AI right now. The studies that we're doing of people being lazier because of AI, right? And we, a long time ago, I'd say more than 10 years ago, we lost the art of writing.
Yes.
Right? Now we get something that can do the work for us. What does that do to our workforce? It's a ripple effect. AI definitely has a use and place in our society, but it can be detrimental if we let it sort of take over the fundamentals of what it is to be human.
Yeah, for sure. I think that's where a lot of people are looking at it in the wrong way. And then that just made me think, I know technically you're not with the federal government anymore, but when you bring up things like AI, water, overheating, mm-hmm. and I think about the grid, when you were there, were there talks about them actually trying to figure out, okay, we need to be more secure?
Yes, 100%.
Because, like, if we go down, because it's like a top-down approach. I think I was talking to her about that over there, about AI and how mm-hmm. everyone's thinking about AI first, but not about securing AI and make sure it is doing what it's supposed to do, so governing it. And so also tying this back in into making sure that the grid is protected in a way that it can withstand these different cyber attacks that these countries are trying to do, because just, I think, 1-2 seconds of no, you know, energy anywhere,
right,
could be detrimental.
It happened in Spain.
Yeah.
Right? Here in the U.S., it was like, what do you mean? What's happening in Spain? The entire country lost power
mm-hmm.
for hours. People were trapped on trains. You think about something like that happening to one region here in the U.S., how many people will die? How long can a hospital last on backup power, right?
Yeah.
Nobody ever considers what happens to our prisons if there's an outage. Yes, they have backup power, but for how long?
Yeah. Like, funny enough, the way that I also know about that is because the guys that I work with in my business stuff, they are in Portugal. Mm-hmm. And so I was like, hey, we'll probably, we currently have power right now, mm-hmm. we'll hopefully have power by, you know, tomorrow or the day after that. And I was like, well, you know, you got something, you be safe over there.
Yeah.
But, like, you know, nobody thinks about it, because, like, I didn't finish watching the show, but on Netflix they had this show called Zero Day.
Yes, yes.
And so you start seeing, like, everything flash. Like, just think about those things malfunctioning. Not even going on ground, but malfunctioning, how many wrecks you're going to have.
How many wrecks are, I mean, everything that we do is based on energy. Right. Just because you don't see it, it's not, you know, touchable field. You turn the light switch on and you expect the power to come on. Right. That's about as far as we think as a typical citizen in the U.S. But when you are trying to function in life, energy is the most vital thing. You cannot function without it. And when you think about even more of what we have in our banks, right, the average household has $400 in the bank. That's not enough to sustain if things go really bad, right? And so while I was at the agency, Biden, you know, he issued an executive order. Don't ask me what the number is, but he issued it to say we need to figure out how to govern AI. And so every agency had an AI office. Then that sort of stemmed into, okay, how does this technology, because it was new, as it related to energy, sort of impact all of this money, right? How do we ensure that the grid is protected? Do we use AI? Do we test it? Do we unleash it, right? Because we could. There was also an element to say, how do we harness it? Like, how do we really use it? And that was probably top of mind for a lot of the national labs doing research. And those supercomputers came into play. When I went to go see one down in Virginia, it was amazing. Like, the operation 24 hours a day to keep this thing going, and that regular people could have access to it, right? You can fill out a form and say, I want to run this program on these servers. I mean, it was phenomenal that we had this kind of resource, but it was also pretty dangerous of what you could get AI to do, because what are the protocols to stop it,
mm-hmm.
right? How do you tell it something horrific, like, I want you to shut down this area of the grid and override yourself, because I'm the one telling you to do it, right? This was done at the Pentagon.
Yeah.
Right? And so everybody was like, oh my gosh, you know, that was sort of the genesis to Biden saying, knock it off. We got to figure this out. Who's going to own it, right?
Yeah.
And so it was a good thing. I don't think we really, in such a short time frame, were able to really leverage the information that we had at the time. I'm hoping that that work is continuing. I doubt it. I know that the initiatives now are energy security. That usually leads to some sort of scare. Temperatures like this, extreme heat, we're not ready for it. We're not prepared.
Yeah. Trust me, down here, I think, you know, they're bullish and Texas is doing their own thing and not using the grid everybody else is using. And that's why people were having, you know, power surges and different. Hey, make sure you only have your air on this because of this. I'm like, oh, my gosh, well, it's hot.
I mean, it's blazing hot. This is not a normal heat, right? And it's not like you all are surrounded by water in certain parts.
And that's what I'm saying. You go even further south, it's more humid.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know how you do it here. And we're struggling. Like I said, we got a heat wave right now of 100 degrees every day for 5 days. My AC broke just the other day. Central air is down. We are scrambling because there aren't enough technicians to come out and help. So there's this, again, there's a ripple effect to not understanding the systems that are operating around you. You know, you only think of energy when it doesn't work. I need people thinking about energy now.
Yeah. For sure. So I know you mentioned your company, Chieftess Consulting. Mm-hmm. What type of things are you involved in right now with Chieftess?
Yeah. So, you know, taking on a new role kind of sort of subdues it a little bit, but I am looking to release the second edition. And so in this edition, I plan on having girl dads, right? Because, you know, energy is dominated by men. And so I've had the privilege of getting to know a lot of them. And girl dads are different, right? Girl dads, they get the insight to say, I can't believe my daughter's going to make less money because she was born a girl. It's eye-opening to have conversations with them because they are the type of people that say, oh, no, 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 my daughter is going to do whatever she wants in life, and I'm going to empower her to do so. And so I made a commitment. I asked a couple of the guys, and I said, you know, can we do portraits of you and your daughter? And we don't really care about you. We can say what the dad does, but, like, what does your daughter want to be? What is she interested in? What's her favorite type of science? You know, when did you introduce the sciences to her? And saying, you know, let's give that lens to folks that don't realize that girl dads are just amazing.
Yeah, that's been a big push ever since. I want to say Kobe kind of made it famous. Like,
yes.
Girl dads have been like that. Yeah. I don't know. Yeah, I actually was content with just being a girl dad.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then I became like, I guess like a, I don't know if you say boy dad or you just become a dad because you got boys and girls.
Yeah.
So I don't know.
Yeah, you are like the dad, right? Because you get the best of both worlds. And the relationships are different, right? And they have to be, and they should be. I sort of suffer with that because I only have my daughter right now. But her dad is awesome and her bonus dad is amazing. And so it's just really important for me because for young women, it's about 7 or 8 where they get influenced to no longer be interested in sciences.
Really?
Yeah.
And that's you know what? Because they always had these polls about, like, when you go to the schools, you know, it may be 1 or 2 girls in the STEM class, regardless of whatever it is, whether you're trying to do tech or you're trying to be engineering, science, mathematics, whatever. It's not too many. And it's like, you know, they're not interested. Now, we have seen a surge over the last couple of years of them being more interested. But I think the pandemic showed people of like, hey, I need a career that I could be flexible in, that they'll be hiring in, that's going to also pay me the money that I can also, like you said, pay attention to my child and not be surviving so much.
Yeah. Well, and then also seeing a lot more girl dads involved to say, like, no, let me share, because I'm an engineer, let me share what I know, right? Your dad pouring into you is just different. Of course, it's beautiful for moms. I'm not knocking any of that. But when you see a dad explain something, I'm not going to call it mansplaining, but explain to their daughter or just to a little girl, there is like a difference in your voice, in your tone that makes us listen with much more focus, right? It's like when your dad yells at you, it's very different from when your mom yells at you. Right. It's just different, at least in my household.
I think it's mostly that's why the women are like, hey, why are you yelling at them? It's
right. Like, right.
Well, they need to listen.
They have to listen. Right. But when you raise your voice, it's different. And so when you are talking to a little girl and saying, here's the knowledge that you need, they listen so attentively. And when they get it, it's like magic because they feel empowered, mm-hmm. right? That you're telling me that someone who gave life to me, my dad, who does something that maybe my mom doesn't or I don't see all the time, is giving me this information. It feels like you just got access to the crown jewels. Like, this is the most important thing in the world because you're taking the time to talk to me and to teach me. And it changes your outlook that you can do this because my dad said so. Mm-hmm. Right? So it's just super important that young girls especially get that. And I don't plan on forever only releasing these books for girls, but I'm seeing that for boys and including my brothers, it's more important for them to build those relationships where they can ask questions. They get to be freer, I'll say.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. And how did you just like get the pictures and then get somebody to turn them into like coloring books?
So I have virtually made zero profit that I've kept. All of the money I have given away to my mentee. She is an artist. She's based in Iowa. And this girl, her name is Amijah. She's phenomenal. She harassed me. She was like, I want you to be my mentor. Please, please, please. And I was like, I don't have time. I don't want to disappoint you. And so initially I said no. And she said, well, okay, fine. Can you help me? And she shared with me that she was part of the adoption system and that she was largely in school doing her thing. She's double major. She's just amazing. And she has a natural talent. She's an artist, mm-hmm. like a true artist, painter, all the things. Graphic design is just her jam. And so I said, okay, how do I do this? And so initially I paid her to do all of the design work. I just paid her out of my own pocket. And then what she didn't realize was that I was going to give her the money to go and study Spanish abroad. And so that's what I did. And that's what I will continue to do, whether it's to her or other students. But when you see a young person who is dedicated to their own success against all of the challenges, I'm willing to make the investment. I don't need the money, but I do need to have passion and purpose in helping other people. That's
actually something I was going to bring up too. It's like you gave like a very passionate speech back in January at the thing in Atlanta.
Yeah.
And I was like, you know, that was probably my first time ever being a part of just some, you know, all black. If people have seen CB4, you see, what's his name? Something, you know, like Alan Payne.
Yes.
And he's like, I'm black, y'all. I'm black, y'all. Black. That's right. Literally like probably my first thing of like, not anybody saying blackity black, of course, but it was like, you know, hey, everybody is black here. All these black people do various things that could help us get to a common goal.
Yeah.
And I guess how, what's the word I want to look for? I guess I'll say, how specific were you in wanting to go that route with that, you and Athora?
My partner would tell you that I am unapologetically black. And I tell white people this all the time. I'm rooting for us to win. I don't care about the competition. I don't care about what you do. I understand that we are in position to always need everybody to be a part of the progress. But my intentionality to help black people that want to help themselves is real. I'm also the person that says, you can't be selective about the type of black people you want to help, right? If you are going to say, I'm black and I'm proud, or I'm unapologetically black, that means that I have to include the black girl with pink hair. It means that I have to include the black man that goes to Morehouse. I have to include all of the different lanes of black folks in wanting them to be successful. And I don't fall into the rhetoric of black excellence is aspiring to be white or to have white success. My excellence says that I want you to be great at whatever it is you do. I don't care what it is, as long as you are not hurting anybody, as long as you are carrying on a legacy that you can be proud of when you are no longer here, I'm willing to do that. So passion is an understatement when I say I support black businesses, I support black people, I support people that are investing in themselves and others, where ego is thrown out the door. If you are unwilling to collaborate, you should find somebody else to work with.
Yeah, for sure. And the funny thing is, like, when you were earlier, you were talking about tired of being the first and this and that. Like, truth be told, because the way that they didn't teach our history the right way, that's why they always say the first to do this and that. But if they kind of teach history before slavery and everything else, you'll find out, like, we're not really the first to do all this thing. It's just they're trying to make it seem like this, because like, who you think taught you guys all the stuff that you know and the stuff you've been doing wrong? Like, who you think taught you all this stuff?
Yeah.
And so when people start doing that, they're studying and going back, they realize, hey, like, this is not like aspiring to be, you know, white. Like, I remember, and this is a separate topic, but it's funny to me. It goes like into history and like how you view things from a child lens versus getting older. You had the story of Pocahontas, and these people telling these people they were savages. Meanwhile, these were actually civilized people over here governing their way of life. And you guys come over here and mess it up and get people sick and kill people because you're the actual savages, don't even know how to clean yourselves correctly. So it's like, it's all about who tried to paint the narrative of what and try to make people feel like what is and what is not. It's like, you know, oh, you're talking white. It's not that. I mean, it was probably a period of time I was like binge listening to a lot of Thomas Sowell, and he was making the correlation between how black people talk to, I think it's somewhere like in Europe or Britain or somewhere where they do all the same things. Like, we be doing this,
right.
You do that.
Right.
So it's like, it comes from somewhere. So it's not just like technically like ghetto. It's like, it's just different.
Yeah.
and that's how people are trying to like paint the narrative for like, if you like, of course there are pockets of us. We know how to put our interview voice on.
Of course.
We know how to, hey, we playing dominoes in space with the family. We know how to talk like that. We know how to do whatever, but because we're multifaceted. But don't try to say someone is wanting to be white because they want to talk, in this case, I'm doing loosely proper English.
Right.
Not to mention, when I was a kid, ain't was not in a dictionary. Ain't was looked at as a bad word, but now it's a word.
Listen, now we have acronyms in the dictionary, right? Like, Webster is picking up everything now. Like, anything that is, you know, if 10,000 people say it enough times, then we're just going to accept it as this is common language, right? We've never spoken the Queen's English, right? Mm-hmm. We've always ruined it in some way. When I say we, I mean Americans. Like, right. Let's be clear. You know, from a young age, depending on where you are in the country, geographic location will dictate how you speak.
Yes.
And that's okay. For sure. The reality is that your language approach, let's call it that, does not dictate your level of intelligence. When I was teaching, the first thing I said to my students were, most of you are speaking English as a second language, which tells me that you are incredibly smart. You've been able to navigate these waters in languages that are incredibly complex, and still articulate yourself, still learn, still get by every day. You are intelligent, more than the average. And so that sort of line of thinking, to think that someone is less than because they don't speak the way that you do, that form of elitism, really, the Northeast, we say, grinds my gears, right? It gets on my nerves, right? It's, who are you to think that your degree given to you by someone that makes you pay for it gives you more worth than someone who decided to do something different? Who are you?
Yeah.
And that's among black people too.
Yeah, it is. That's one of those, I don't want to do this. Like I said, I don't like to do the stereotype thing, right? For me, I respect everybody making an honest living because I have a background, come from a blue collar family. Mm-hmm. So I respect that. Like, regardless of what degrees I have, it really doesn't mean much to me. I don't really tout it like, hey, I have this. It's only when I'm talking to somebody for a job or something and they may be surprised, like, they say, oh, you have a bachelor's, and I had to tell a recruiter, I said, well, I got a master's. She's like, oh, okay. I'm like, but other than that, it's nothing, because I did more learning outside of school than I did actually in school. And so you'll have people, and women do it, men do it too, depending on where they're at. They're fun, those things, like, they mean something to, they only mean something to you. They don't mean something to everybody. Because like you said, you got all, you know, you got more degrees than a thermostat on the wall.
Yeah.
But you can't fix the AC.
Right.
So it's right. Like, what is it? At that point in time, that degree is meaningless because it does not help you say, how do I get the AC back on?
Listen, when my sump pump went and it was Easter weekend and I was down in that basement with boots on, pulling it, the degree meant nothing. It mm-hmm. meant that you needed to figure it out. For me, your level of intelligence is problem solving. It's mm-hmm. being able to find the resources to get it done. Because I know plenty of PhD folks that are dumb as rocks, can't function in day-to-day life. And so I never put that much stock in a degree because I know that it's really a commitment. Doesn't mm-hmm. mean when you graduate with a degree that you passed with A's. Right? It doesn't mean that you've truly mastered whatever it is that you were studying. It means that you did enough to get through it.
Yes, for sure. For sure. So I have probably a couple more questions for you. One of them was going to be, What advice would you give to young professionals, particularly Black women looking to make their mark in STEM or energy?
I always tell people reading is fundamental, right? But getting along is really important. Doesn't mean that you hide yourself. Some people ask me, like, when were you able to wear your hair out, right? This is a big question for Black women in corporate, right? And STEM in particular. When can you be authentically you? Let me help you understand. The corporate world doesn't want the authentically you, because authentically you could be a bitch, right? Mm-hmm. But we want your authentic professional self in a workplace. Be that. If you have an issue with that, you're going to have to start your own company.
Yeah.
Right? Get over it. I don't know what to tell you, but corporate is not going to accept you being mean or rude or from anybody, not because you're a Black woman, but from anybody. They don't want it from a white woman. They don't want it from a Black man. They don't want it from anybody. So I would say the biggest advice is reading is fundamental. Opportunities are going to come in text, right? Read your emails, do your due diligence, and learn to get along and be your professional, authentic self. And understand that you got to hustle for your last name, not your first. Your last name. When you start doing business and doing things in STEM that are planting seeds for a forest, you will never see. You move differently. You make decisions differently. This is not for you. You might live 100 years. God willing, you don't work the whole 100 years, right? So whatever impact you're looking to make, do it with your legacy in mind.
Yeah, nice. And then I also was going to ask you too, how does somebody start like a career in energy? Like, do they just go to like, let's for instance, your company, do they just go look for careers? Like,
yes.
Is there a prereq that they have to go to school or what?
No, because, all right, if you want to be an engineer, yes, you're going to need a degree. We need you to understand some things. You can't be out here designing energy systems and have no background, right? So you're going to have to do that. But there are clerical jobs. We still have secretaries. We still have technicians, where you don't need to have a degree to do these jobs at all. There are so many opportunities. And remember, you have different technologies. So you might be doing geothermal. You might be doing solar. You might be doing offshore wind, onshore wind. You know, the list is long for different types of technologies. So the opportunities are going to be there. You don't need a degree. You need to be willing to roll with change. Change will be your catalyst for success because it's constantly evolving. So you've got to have the mindset of pivot. All right, they're asking me to do this. All right, fine, I can do that. You know, set yourself up for success in that way. Mm-hmm. I would say sort of the best exposure would be starting at a utility company. Only because utilities are the gatekeepers of all things in energy, right? They'll be the exception of, I want my own power grid. People don't understand that not every state allows you to generate power on your own. There are places in this country where you cannot collect rainwater. It is against the law. Look at Colorado, right? Can't collect it there. So utility companies would be the best way to get in, but any small company is a great start. They're usually incredibly passionate about energy, and you can learn a lot. Expose yourself to it, though. Like, get out and network. Get with ABE, which is the American Association of Blacks in Energy. They have over 40 chapters. There's one in every state, with the exception of some weird places in the country that you just won't find us, but your neighboring state or your regional president is happy to engage. And it's all volunteers that already work in energy. So they're happy to have you.
Great. So I also asked you this, is what's one thing that I didn't ask you that you thought I would have asked you?
Oh, something that you would have asked me. Probably about the work-life balance. Most people ask me about like the stress of having a high-profile position, being in places and spaces. Like, a lot of people have said, like, what's the worst thing that ever happened to you while in your career?
You know what? I never thought about asking something like that. Because I know, like, this is off topic, but like, I was on this on-site for work the other day, well, last month, and like one of the questions they had us ask in the stand-up was like, hey, what's the most, you know, boring thing about you or something like that? Like, it's just like a random thing, like a question to ask you versus like something interesting. It's like, hey, what's something boring about you?
Yeah. People like the boring thing, if that was going to be the question, is like, I hate movies. unless they're like action-packed movies, really? Right? I'm not watching them.
You didn't see Sinners?
I love TV shows. I did see Sinners.
Okay.
I said I was unapologetically black. Come on. And I loved it. So,
me too.
Yeah, thank you, Ryan, for creating that. I love TV shows because I like forming characters. I like getting attached to people, right? Like, you then start to identify those people in your head. And so the weird part about television for me is that I don't watch television. I listen to it. So I watched the first episode and my partner hates it because I'm looking at my phone. I'm doing a million things, but I know exactly what's happening because my brain is auditory. So I just hear the voices and I make the pictures. It all happens in my head. And occasionally I'll look up, but I don't have to.
So do you like audiobooks?
I love audiobooks. Yeah. I love it because especially when a book has become a television series and I've watched or listened to that television series, like Michael C. Hall, who was Dexter in the HBO series.
Okay.
They were books first, but he now narrates the audiobooks.
Interesting.
It's so good because now I have
the
character.
I like the books more than the show because the show oftentimes is not concise with what happens in the books. Because like I haven't really read any of his new books in a while, but I'm a Carl Weber fan. Mm. And so recently his Family Business seasons are like on Netflix now and they're on BET. So they're waiting for the new season to come out. But the first episode is vastly different from the first book. And so you're listening to these things.
But the
books are better because
the books are
how
better
vivid
for Dexter.
You can get with your imagination and reading the words on
there.
It's stuff that's a lot of times cannot be recreated on TV.
I wholeheartedly agree, which is why I own the entire Dexter series. And people are like, why do you like a serial killer? Because he kills bad people. Come on. Like, there's nothing else out there like that I've found. So I'm definitely that person that has a vivid imagination, which is sometimes scary because it means that I hold on to information that usually doesn't matter to anybody else. So like I'm full of useless facts.
That's what I say. Are you one of those people that knows a little bit about everything?
Yes.
Like I'm pretty sure you enjoy Jeopardy.
Yeah. It's one of my favorite shows outside of Golden Girls. Okay.
Really?
Yeah.
I used to watch both with my mom.
Yeah. My grandmother. I'm like an old lady. A lady in the sense of like Jeopardy, Golden Girls, Matlock. Like, I'm old school in that way. Like, I'm watching Sherlock.
What about The Price is Right?
Yeah.
Did you ever watch Supermarket Sweep?
Yeah, of course. Because I wanted to be on that show with my mom. Did. Like, come on. Getting, you know, the $25 hams and come on. Mm-hmm. That was an amazing show. They need to bring that back. Inflation is real.
Yeah. I don't know. They could try to do it. But what's next for you? And then after what's next for you, how can the listeners like keep in touch with you?
Yeah. So what's next is progress. Progress in this current role. What's next is really continuing to educate, right? I'm an educator at heart. And I want people to understand the energy system and where we're going, even where we've been. Energy justice communities are real in this country. People are still having to decide between food and paying their electric bill, right? And so sometimes when you reach a certain level in life, you forget that people are struggling.
Mm-hmm.
And you become, you know, detached. And so I want to remind people that you might be okay, but poverty comes for you in the middle of the night. It's a car accident. It's an illness. It's a fire. It's anything. So don't forget that there are still people that need your support. They need your help. And that comes with equity. Really, it does. So that's what's next, is continuing the push for equity and energy.
Nice, nice. Yeah. And where can I follow you at?
I am on Instagram. I'm pretty active. So it's at Shalaya M. So S-H-A-L-A-Y-A-M as in Morissette, which is my last name, like Alanis, no relation. I am on LinkedIn. There's no other Shalaya Morissette. So if you type me in, I'm there. I tried the TikTok thing. I just can't get into it. Threads, I'm there, but I don't engage with it too much. But probably Instagram and LinkedIn is where you can find me. I'm super responsive to email. So if you send me a note on LinkedIn, I will say, here's my email address. Shoot me a note. I am very responsive to email. Yeah. Okay. And then for Chieftis, it's chieftisconsulting.com.
Perfect, perfect, guys. So if you want to check her out and when if you want to check her, do her jump ropes out, go check her out on Instagram.
Yes.
But, this has been another episode of Textual Talk. Like I always say, let's stay textual and we out. Peace.